Through the efforts alone of my silver tongue and tin-quick mind, I gained access to Lady Levant's private party in New Saren, wherein she planned to auction the only remaining buttons from the Lord Mistborn's favorite smoking jacket. Handrawim, my faithful Terrasman steward, had prized the information that the leader of the Cobbles Guilders planned to steal the buttons by swapping them with impeccable forgeries at some point during the night. As Handrawim watched the tin buttons from the hors d'oeuvres table, I rubbed elbows with Lady Levant and her inner circle, who found me completely enchanting. That was when the man in the striped white suit pointed a gun at me. Continued below. Ellendale feels effects of Corbeau flooding. Higher commodities prices to impact market performance. As one of the basin's key grain-producing regions struggles to rebuild following the breaking of the dam near Corbeau, unanswered questions still threaten the comfort of those at the heart of the basin. The Argean Ore Financial Circle, Ellendale's largest and most prestigious committee of bankers and other financial leaders, has called an emergency meeting to discuss sending aid to the flood-ravaged area. The biggest question haunting the circle is if the investment of boxings and resources will be enough to affect the commodities markets, which are just now beginning to founder under the prediction of grain harvests half as large as last year's. There are enough supplies in reserve to meet most demands over the next 4 months, said Lord Chapmont Heviers, a circle member with strong ties to Corbeau. But after that, most grain will start going to the highest bidder. If you own bakeries, you will think twice about selling loaves at 5 clips each, when you could be selling whiskey at 40 clips a bottle. All children love Suni Pops. You can move its legs. Real fur. Your child's new best friend. Only 75 clips, or one boxing 50 for two. Viff Sparkle Tonic cures fatigue. Doctors Franks and Sylvest Viff have the remedy for drowsiness and irritability caused by animalcules, ulcers, and poor nutrition. Remember what the doctors say. Drink Viff Sparkle Tonic every day. Pectin Aid. The basin's favorite snack. Try all 8 flavors. Only 10 clips a box. You'll be glad you stayed for Pectin Aid. Guest Editorial. The nuisance of negligent coin shots. In the last 16 months, I have replaced 3 lampposts, an iron gate, and 2 steeple spires, all at my Madison Ways house. My residence in the 6th octant, much nearer the hub, has needed twice that attention, due to it being on visitors from other worlds. The sinister soiree continued. I described my assailant as wearing a striped white suit, but that is not as specific as it may seem. In Ellendale, someone dressed as described would stick out like afternoon tea among Kolos. But in New Saren, the men... 6. Wax soared through the air above Ellendale, hat held by strings to his neck, mistcoat waving behind him like a banner. Below, the city bustled and moved, people swarming through its roadway arteries. Some glanced at him, but most ignored him. Allomancers were not the rarity here they had been in the roughs. All these people, Wax thought, pushing off a fountain shaped like mists condensing into harmony, with arms upraised, bracers glittering golden on the otherwise green copper statue. Women sat on its stone edge. Children played in its waters. Motor cars and horse carriages broke around it, sweeping to the sides and charging down other roads, going about the ever-important business of city life. So many people. And here, in the 4th octant, a frightening percentage of them were his responsibility. To begin with, he paid their wages, or oversaw those who did. On the solvency of his house rested the financial stability of thousands upon thousands. But that was only part of it, because through his seat in the Senate, he represented any who worked for him, or who lived on properties he owned. 2 divisions within the Senate. One side, the representatives of the professions, was elected and came and went as people's needs changed. The other side, the seats of the noble houses, was stable and immutable, not subject to the whims of voters. The governor, elected by the seats, presided over them all, A good enough system, except it meant that Wax was supposed to look after tens of thousands of individuals he could never know. His eye twitched, and he turned, pushing off some rebar sloppily left sticking from a tenement wall. Towns were better in the roughs, where you could know everyone. That way you could care for them, and really feel you were doing something. Marcy would argue that statistically leading his house here was more effective in creating general human happiness, but he wasn't a man of numbers. He was a man who trusted his gut. His gut missed knowing the people he served. Wax landed on a large water tower near a glass dome covering his octant's largest church of the survivor. People were worshipping inside, though a greater number would come at dusk to await the mists. The church revered the mists, and yet with that glass dome they still separated themselves from it. Wax shook his head, then pushed off along the nearby canal. "He's probably finished by now," Wax thought. "He'll be on one of the nearby docks, listening to the lapping water." He continued along the canal, which was cluttered with boats. Twindall Promenade, which ran along this canal, was crowded, even more so than usual, dense with life. It was difficult not to feel subsumed by the great city, engulfed, overwhelmed, insignificant. Out in the roughs, Wax hadn't just enforced the law. He had interpreted it, revised it when needed. He had been the law. Here he had to dance around egos and secrets. As Wax searched for the right dock, he was surprised to eventually find the reason for the traffic on the promenade. It was all bunched up, trying to get through a large clot of men with signs. Wax passed overhead and was shocked to see a small cluster of constables from the local octant amid the picketers. They were being pressed on all sides by the shouting men, waving signs in an uncomfortably violent manner. Wax dropped through the air and pushed lightly on the nails in the promenade boards here, slowing his descent. He landed in a crouch in an opening nearby, mistcoat flaring, guns clinking. The picketers regarded him for a long moment, then broke apart, taking off in different directions. He didn't even have to say a word. In moments, the beleaguered constables emerged, like stones on the plain as the soil washed away in a sudden rain.
"Thanks, sir,"
said their captain, an older woman whose blonde hair poked down straight about an inch on all sides around her constable's hat. "They're getting violent?" Wax asked, watching the last of the picketers vanish. "Didn't like us trying to move them off the promenade, Dawnshot," the woman said. She shivered. "Didn't expect it to go so bad, so fast."
"Can't say I blame them much,"
one of the other constables said, a fellow with a neck like a long-barreled pistol. His fellows turned to him, and he hunched down.
"Look, you can't say you don't have mates among them. You can't say you haven't heard them grumble. Something needs to change in this city. That's all I'm saying."
"They don't have the right to block a main thoroughfare," Wax said, "no matter their grievances. Report back to your precinct and make sure you bring more men next time." They nodded, hiking off. The promenade's knot of pedestrians slowly unwound itself, and Wax shook his head, worried. The men running the strikes did have a grievance. He'd found some of the same problematic conditions among the few factories he owned. Long hours, dangerous environments, and had been forced to fire a few overseers because of it. He'd replaced them with overseers who instead would hire more men for shorter shifts, as there was no shortage of laborers in the city who were out of work these days. But then he'd needed to up wages so that the men could live on the shorter shift income, making his goods more costly. Difficult times. And he didn't have the answers. Not to those problems. He hiked along the promenade a short distance, drawing more than a few stares from people he passed. But he soon found what he was looking for. Wayne sat on a narrow dock nearby. He had his shoes and socks off, feet in the water, and was staring off down the canal.
"Hello, Wax," he said, without looking as Wax stepped up.
"It went poorly?" Wax asked.
"Same as always. It's strange. Most days I don't mind being me. Today I do."
Wax crouched down, resting a hand on the younger man's shoulder.
"Do you ever wonder if you should have just shot me?" Wayne asked. "Back when you and John first found me?"
I'm not in the habit of shooting people who can't shoot back, Wax said.
I could have been faking.
No, you couldn't have been. Wayne had been a youth of 16 when Wax and John Deadfinger, a lawman who had been mentoring Wax, had found him curled up in the crawlspace under a house, hands over his ears, cloaked in dirt and whimpers. Wayne had thrown his guns and ammunition down a well. Even as Deadfinger had dragged him out, Wayne had been complaining of the gunfire, shots only he could hear, echoing from that well.
Any number of the boys we run across and take down, Wayne said. Any of them could be like me. Why did I get a second chance? But none of them did.
Luck. Wayne turned to meet his eyes. I'd give those lads second chances if I could, Wax said. Maybe they've had their moments of doubt, regret. But the ones we shoot, we don't find unarmed, hiding, willing to be brought in. We find them killing. And if I'd found you in the process of armed robbery all those years ago, I'd have shot you too.
You're not lying, are you?
Of course not. I'd have shot you right in the head, Wayne.
You're a good friend, Wayne said. Thanks, Wax.
You're the only person I know that I can cheer up by promising to kill him.
You didn't promise to kill me, Wayne said, pulling on his socks. You promised to have killed me. That there be the present perfect tense.
Your grasp of the language is startling, Wax said, considering how you frequently brutalize it.
Ain't nobody what knows the cow better than the butcher, Wax.
I suppose, Wax said, standing up.
Have you ever met a woman named Idashwi? A ferrochemist? Steel runner?
Wax nodded.
Never met her, Wayne said. They keep kicking me out of the village when I visit. Right on neighborly.
So far as Wax knew, that wasn't true. Wayne would occasionally toss on some terrace robes, mimic their accents, then sneak in to live among them for a few days. He'd eventually get into trouble for saying something crude to one of the young women, but he wouldn't get thrown out. He'd baffle them, as he did most people, until he got bored and wandered away.
Let's see what we can find, Wax said,
waving down a canal gondola.
5 notes for 1 basket of apples? That's robbery!
Marcy hesitated on the street. She'd driven the motor car up to the hub for the governor's speech, then parked it with the coachman who took pay to watch and refuel motors, intending to walk the rest of the way on foot. The hub could be a busy place. That letter here, near this small street market with people selling fruit. With disbelief, she saw that one vendor was, indeed, selling apples at 5 notes a basket. Those shouldn't cost more than half a boxing per basket at most. She'd seen them for a handful of clips.
I could get these at Ellen's stand for a fraction of the price, the customer said.
Well, why don't you go see if he has any left?
The cart owner said, nonplussed. The customer stormed off, leaving the cart owner with her sign proudly proclaiming the ridiculous price. Marcy frowned, then glanced down the row of stands, barrels, and carts. Suspiciously low quantities all round. She walked up to the cart owner with the high prices. The woman stood stiffly, braids shaking, and shoved her hands into the pockets of her apron.
Officer, she said. 5 is on the high side, wouldn't you say?
Marcy asked, picking up an apple.
Unless these are infused with atium.
Am I doing anything wrong?
The woman asked.
You have the right to set your prices, Marcy said. One simply wonders what you seem to know that nobody else does.
The woman didn't respond.
Shipment coming late? Marcy asked. Apple harvest gone bad?
The woman sighed.
Not apples, officer. Green shipments out of the east. Simply not coming. Floods did them in.
A little early to be speculating on food prices, don't you think?
Pardon, officer, but do you know how much food this city eats? We're 1 shipment away from starvation, we are.
Marcy glanced down the row again. Food was moving quickly, most of it, from what she could see, being sold to the same group of people. Speculators grabbing up the fruits and sacks of grain. The city wasn't as close to starvation as the cart owner claimed, there were storages that could be released, but bad news moved faster than calm winds. And there was a good chance this woman was right, that she'd be able to sell her apples at a premium until things calmed down in a few days. Marcy shook her head, setting down the apple, and continuing toward the hub. There was always a press here, people on the promenade, vehicles on the streets trying to force their way into the ring around the hub. More people today, crowds drawn by the speech causing traffic clots in the regular bustle. Marcy could barely make out the giant statues of the Ascendant Warrior and her husband in the Field of Rebirth, peeking out over the throng. Marcy walked up to join another group of constables who had just arrived on Aradel's orders, their carriages lagging behind her motor car. Together they wended their way through the streets on foot toward the executive mansion. The governor preferred to address people from its steps, a few streets up into the second octant from the hub. They soon reached the large square before the mansion. Moving here was more difficult, but fortunately the constables from this octant were already in attendance, and they had roped off various areas near the front and sides of the square. In one, dignitaries and noblemen sat on bleachers to hear the address. In another, the second octant constables clustered and watched the crowd for pickpockets from the steps up into the National Archives. Other constables moved through the crowd, officers readily identifiable by the blue plumes on their hats. Marcy and Lieutenant Javies, who had commanded the field team, made their way toward the National Archives, where their colleagues from the second octant let them pass. A mustachioed older constable was directing things here, his helm under his arm, bearing the double plume of a captain. When he saw Marcy, Javies, and the team, the man lit up.
"Ah, so Aradel sent me reinforcements after all," he exclaimed. "Resting wonderful. You chaps go watch the east side of the square, down Longguard Street. Foundry workers are gathering there, and they don't look too pleasant. This isn't the place for their picket lines, I dare say. Maybe an eyeful of constable uniforms will keep them in check."
"Sir," Javies said, saluting, "those masses are pushing up against the steps to the mansion. With respect, sir, don't you want us up there?"
"Governor's guards have jurisdiction, Lieutenant," the old captain said. "They brush us back if we try to do anything on the actual mansion grounds. Damn pewter-necked bulls. They barely give us warning any time the governor wants to have a say to the people, then expect us to do the hard work of policing this mess."
Javies saluted, and his team ran off.
"Sir," Marcy said, remaining behind, "Constable General Aradel wanted me to bring him a direct report on the speech. Do you think I could get a spot on those bleachers to watch?"
"No luck there," the captain said. "Every niece and nanny of a house lord has demanded a spot. They'll gut me if I send someone else over."
"Thank you anyway, sir. I'll see if I can work my way to the front of the crowd."
Marcy moved off.
"Wait, constable," the old man said. "Don't I know you?"
She looked back, blushing.
"I'm
Lord Holmes's girl," the old captain said. "The bastard, that's it. Now don't get red-faced, that's not meant as an insult, child. Just what you are, and that's it, simple as day. I like your father. He was bad enough at cards to be fun to play against, but he was careful not to bet so much that I felt bad winning."
"Sir."
News of her nature, once kept discreet, had moved through all of high society. Hanging around Waxillium, who created such stirs, did have its drawbacks, and her mother did have something of a reason for her angry letters. Marcy was quite accepting of what she was. That didn't mean she liked having it thrown at her. Old nobleman officers like this, though, well, they came from a time when they felt they could say whatever they wanted, particularly about their subordinates.
"There's space with the reporters, Little Harms," he said, pointing. "Up near the north side. Not great for watching, as you'll have steps in your way, but a great place for listening. Tell Constable Wells at the rope I said you could pass, and give my best to your father."
She saluted, still wrestling with a mixture of shame and indignation. He didn't mean anything by his comments, but rust and ruin. She had worked most of her life, swept under the rug with a few coins in her hand, her father refusing to openly acknowledge her. Among the constables, at least, couldn't she be known for her professional accomplishments, not the nature of her birth? Still, she wouldn't turn down the opportunity for a better spot, so she began to work her way around the square toward the section he'd specified. What was that? Wax thought. He spun to look away from the group of beggars he'd been questioning.
Wax?
Wayne called, turning away from another group of people.
What?
Wax ignored him, shoving through a crowd on the street toward the thing he'd seen. A face.
It can't be.
His frantic actions drew annoyed shouts from some people, but only dark glares from others. The days when a nobleman, even an allomancer, could quell with a look were passing. Wax eventually stumbled into a pocket of open ground and spun about.
Where?
Wild, every sense straining, he dropped a bullet casing and pushed, instantly popping up about 10 feet. Scanning, he whirled, the motion flaring his mistcoat tassels. The heavy flow of people on Tindwill Promenade continued toward the hub, near which the governor would apparently be making a speech.
"It's a dangerous crowd,"
a piece of him noticed. There were too many men wearing battered coats and bearing battered expressions. The labor issue was becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Half the city was underpaid and overworked. The other half was simply out of work. A strange dichotomy. He kept seeing men loitering on corners. Now they flowed together in streams that would create dangerous rapids, as when a real river met rocks. Wax landed, heart thrumming like the drum of a march. He'd been sure of it this time. He had seen Bloody Tan in that crowd of men. A brief glimpse of a familiar face, the mortician killer, the last man Wax had hunted in the roughs before coming to Ellendale. The man who had caused Lessie's death.
Wax?
Wayne hurried up.
Wax, you all right? You look like you ate an egg you found in the gutter.
It's nothing, Wax said.
Aw,
Wayne said.
Then that look I saw. You were just contemplating your impending marriage to Steris, I guess.
Wax sighed, turning away from the crowds.
I imagined it. I must have imagined it.
I wish you'd leave Steris alone. She's not nearly so bad as you make her sound.
That's the same thing you said about that horse you bought. You remember? The one who only bit me?
Roseweather had good taste. Did you find anything? Wayne nodded, leading them out of the press of traffic.
Miss Steelrunner settled down nearby, all right, he said. She got a job doing bookkeeping for a jeweler down the road. She hasn't come in to work in over a week, though. The jeweler sent someone to her flat, but nobody answered the door.
You got the address? Wax asked.
Of course I did.
Wayne looked offended, shoving his hands into the pockets of his duster.
Got me a new pocket watch, too.
He held up one made of pure gold, with opaline workings on the face. Wax sighed. After a short trip back to the jeweler to return the watch, Wayne claimed he figured it had been for trade, since it had been sitting out on the counter with naught but a little box of glass around it. They made their way up the road to the Bornton district. This was a high-quality neighborhood, which also meant it had less character. No laundry airing in front of buildings, no people sitting on the steps. Instead, the street was lined by white townhouses and rows of apartment buildings with spiky iron decorations around their upper windows. They checked the address with one of the local newsboys and eventually found themselves in front of the apartment building in question.
Someday I'd like to live in a fancy place like this,
Wayne said wistfully.
Wayne, you live in a mansion. It ain't fancy. It's opulent. Big difference.
Which is?
Mostly it involves which kinds of glasses you drink out of, and what kind of art you hang.
Wayne looked offended.
You need to know these things now, Wax, being filthy rich and all.
Wayne, you're practically rich yourself, after the reward from the Banisher's case. Wayne shrugged. He hadn't touched his share of that, which had been paid out mostly in aluminum recovered from Miles and his gang. Wax led the way up the steps running along the outside of the building. Idashwi's place was at the top, a small apartment on the rear with a view only of the back of other buildings. Wax slipped Vindication out of her holster, then knocked, standing to the side of the door in case someone shot through it. No response.
Nice door,
Wayne said softly.
Good wood.
He kicked it open. Wax leveled his gun and Wayne ducked inside, sliding up against the wall to avoid being backlit. He found a switch a moment later, turning on the room's electric lights. Wax raised the gun beside his head, pointing at the ceiling, and swept in. The apartment wasn't much to look at. The pile of folded blankets in the corner probably served as a bed. With steel sight, Wax saw no moving bits of metal. Everything was still and calm. Wax peeked into the bathroom while Wayne moved over to the only other room in the apartment, a kitchen. Indoor plumbing for the bathroom, electric lights. This was a fancy place. Most terrorists claimed to prefer simple lives. What had led her to pay for something like this?
"Aw, hell," Wayne said from the kitchen. "That ain't no fun."
Wax moved over, gun out, and glanced around the corner into the kitchen. It was just large enough for one person to lie down in. He knew this because of the bloody corpse stretched out on the floor, her chest bearing a large hole in the center, her eyes staring sightlessly into the air.
"Looks like we're going to need a new prime suspect, Wax," Wayne said. "This one downright refuses to not be dead already."
Maris's position at the speech turned out to be exactly as advertised, nestled into a narrow gap in the crowd formed by the side steps of the mansion's forecourt. Around her, the members of the press clutched pencils and pads, ready to jot down bite-sized quotes from the governor's speech that might make good headlines. Maracy was the only constable among them, and her lieutenant's bars didn't earn her much consideration from the reporters. Their view was obstructed not only by the position of the wide stone steps, but also by the governor's guard, a row of men and women in dark suits and hats, standing with hands clasped behind their backs along the steps. Only a pair of sketch artists, who stood at one corner of the knot of reporters, had anything resembling a good view of the governor's platform, which had been erected on the steps. That was fine with Maracy. She didn't need to see much of Innate to digest and relate his words. Besides, this position gave her an excellent view of the gathering crowd, which she found more interesting. Dirty men stained with soot from work in the factories. Tired women who, because of the advent of electricity, could now be forced to work much longer hours, well into the night, with a threat of dismissal to keep them at the loom. Yet there was hope in those eyes, hope that the governor would have encouragement to offer, a promised end to the city's growing strain.
"Mirabelle's rules," Maracy thought, nodding to herself.
Mirabelle had been a statistician and psychologist in the 3rd century who had studied why some people worked harder than others. Turned out a man or woman was much more likely to do good work if they were invested, if they felt ownership of what they did and could see that it mattered. Her personal studies proved that crime went down when people had a sense of identity with and ownership of their community. That was the problem, because modern society was eroding those concepts. Life seemed more transient now, with people commonly relocating and changing jobs during their lifetime, things that had almost never happened a century ago. Progress had forced it upon them. These days, Ellendale just didn't need as many carriage drivers as it did automobile repairmen. You had to adapt, move, change. That was good, but it could also threaten identity, connection, and sense of purpose. The governor's guards studied the crowd with hostility, muttering about miscreants, as if seeing the crowd as barely contained malefactors who were looking for any excuse to riot and loot. To the contrary, these people wanted something stable, something that would let them sustain their communities or forge new ones. Rioting was rarely caused by greed, but frequently by frustration and hopelessness. The governor finally made his appearance, stepping from the mansion. Maracy caught a few fragmentary glimpses of him between the legs of the guards. Innate was a tall, handsome man, unlike his brother, who had always seemed dumpy to Maracy. Clean-shaven, with a wave in his salt-and-pepper hair and a trendy set of spectacles, Innate was the first governor to pose for his official portrait wearing spectacles. Would he know? Would he understand how to calm these people? He was corrupt, but it was a quiet kind of corruption. Little favors done to enrich himself or his friends. It was quite possible he did care for the people of his city, even while enriching himself. He stepped up to his platform, where a diminutive woman in a green dress skittered around, adjusting devices that looked like big cones, with their wide openings facing the crowd. Maracy felt she should